You are listening to Independence West on VOA.
We got Roger Muntu here in the studio. We got Roger Muntu in the production booth. Rohit Kulkarni cannot join us today. François Sou, which is much more shocking, cannot join us today either. In spite of this, you're listening to Independence West. We keep on trucking, and I'm Robert D. Sir Alex Ferguson is going to be retiring as manager of Manchester United after 27 years in charge of the Premier League club. An insane run of success he's had. In a couple of minutes, we're going to be talking to a Cameroonian journalist in the UK, as well as an Indian media commentator based in Mumbai and New Delhi. Insane run of success for Sir Alex that included 2 European Cups, 13 Premier League / English Championship titles. No, I think it was always Premier League from 93 onwards, and 10 Community Shields, among other things. So we have the discussion. We're going to go right away to JP Esso, who's a Cameroonian journalist who's based in the United Kingdom. Thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yes, and also we have Venkat Anant, who I think is based in Mumbai or in Delhi.
Yes, hello, hi.
Yes.
I'm in Delhi.
And he's a former journalism lecturer who loves to comment, and that's your Twitter handle, from what I understand. You love to comment on anything from foreign affairs to cricket. And I understand, Venkat, we're going to start with you, that you're a Manchester United fan as well, aren't you?
Yes, I am. A very good one at that. A very proud one at that.
So tell me one thing. Where were you? Is it one of those "where was I" moments when you heard that Sir Alex Ferguson was going to retire as manager of Manchester United? And what kind of an effect did it have, you know, on you and your community of friends who presumably support Manchester United as well?
Well, I got a phone call at 6 o'clock in the morning. This was obviously it was a phone call I wasn't expecting. I was obviously sleeping. I heard, you know, Twitter had gone abuzz with these rumors, and then there was a story by the Telegraph, which presumably spoke about the retirement, and the word using there was was considering, and it obviously, up to the time the announcement happened, there was obviously a lot of expectation. There was anxiety. I mean, this is a guy, and he's the only manager I've known of Manchester United, because I'm myself a 26-year-old, and the moment you realized that he was going to retire, there was a certain numbness you felt. You felt sick, but at the same time you could realize that, you know, he's going out on a high. He's 71, so you got to give him that the fact that it had to come either this year or maybe next season. So there was certainly, it took a while to sink in. I think it took me about a day to realize that Alex Ferguson is not going to be a manager come August next year. But it's also exciting. I mean, the fact that the club moved in within 48 hours to get a replacement who I believe will do a fantastic job. Considering he's long term. And he's got the similar qualities. I think it's an exciting time to be a United fan. Yeah.
But, you know, it's fantastic what he has been able to accomplish. I mean, JPSO, you have a blog in which you wrote this past week, okabol.net, I think it was, or correct me, but you wrote about... okabol.com. OKABOL.com, right?
Yes.
And you've written about Sir Alex's retirement this past week. Do you expect his record to be surpassed by anyone ever? I mean, is it possible to even fathom, to imagine that run of success?
I think that football has changed, through the years. You know, nobody can stay that long, in a bench, because, you know, football's changed. The money is involved now, and people like him or Arsene Wenger or David Moyes, they spend like 10 years, and more with their clubs. And, now those guys, they just want to, taste something else every two years, like Mourinho or people like that. You know, they're so successful, but they want to be successful everywhere. So I don't think somebody like Sir Alex will be in the next decade or so.
Venkat, I mean, successful as Manchester United have been under Sir Alex's tenure, they're also an immensely indebted club. And Manchester United has become perhaps the crown jewel in that upper class of clubs that, you know, seem to win everything every year, or at least seem to be in contention to do that, but somehow they can't quite get their finances in order. I mean, can you have, you know, that run of success these days without seeming to be on the brink of insolvency somehow?
Well, I think United's finances have been improving in the last couple of years. There's no doubt that the flotation has helped to an extent. We do have, as you know, we have about, you know, 33 commercial partners who are with us, and the list is only going to increase. I think in that sense, the finance isn't as much an issue, but I think what you're going to see is, you've already seen the likes of Chelsea and Manchester City and Paris Saint-Germain from France. You have these clubs who are spending incessantly in search for glory, and United, I think, over the years have been, there was a number, there was a stat that came out the other day where Man City have spent in 5 years what United have spent under Ferguson in the Premier League era. So you're going to have a stage where these clubs are going to put more money into getting trophies. But with United, I think the key is, obviously, they believe in the sort of, you know, facilities that we've created there. You have a huge emphasis on youth development and bringing through the player and bringing through players the right way. So I think United will be expected to win trophies. I'm sure they would be, but I think now is the time for patience. Sure, you know, David Moyes could go and win us the league in the first season, but it's time to be patient. It's not going to be as immediate. Yes, and I do believe the fans have been spoiled by Alex Ferguson to an extent, because we've just kept winning every other year. If not the year, you know, the next year it's immediate, and we do win more trophies. So yeah, I think in that sense, you know, you can say that.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, JP, there are lots of teams that spend a lot of money on players, but certainly very few teams. I mean, Manchester United is unique in its kind of success. I mean, I can only think of Bayern Munich, you know, as their possible rivals in terms of domestic success and European success, all that sort of things. So what was it, in your opinion, that just made Manchester United so effective? Is it Alex Ferguson's talent as a tactician? Was it his ability to handle stars? What was it?
I think Alex, you know, had like people to look up to, you know, people like the previous history of the club. You know, the club used to win, you know, in the 50s and the 60s, and then they were less successful, and then he came, and then he rose the team back from nothing. So I think Manchester, it's about him, Sir Alex, because he was successful in Aberdeen. And then I think the people in Manchester, you know, they love football, you know, that city has two big clubs. And then I think the fans are a part of it, I think. You know?
Yeah, and of course, you mentioned Aberdeen. Venkat, Sir Alex was Aberdeen manager when they last won the Scottish Championship, which was, I think, in the mid-1980s, wasn't it?
Early 1980s, yeah. 83, he won the European Cup Winners' Cup with Aberdeen, beating Real Madrid.
Yes.
I think that, you know, to put Alex Ferguson in perspective, you need to go back to the Aberdeen days. The fact that they won a European Cup Winners' Cup, for a club like Aberdeen, he completely dismantled the old firm reign, which is Celtic and Rangers in Scotland, and made Aberdeen the third force in that country. And importantly, he won the European Cup Winners' Cup without or with homegrown players. I think only two players were purchased from by the club. So there is, so that was the foundation, or that was the philosophy that he carried on to Manchester United. Yes, it didn't happen in the first 4 years, but I think the moment he won his first trophy, you could see that. I think the players had a lot of confidence after that, and the fact that he believed in doing things the right way and give opportunities to players who he thought were good enough to play for Manchester United, and that is his best contribution. You know, the 95, as we all know, there was a famous quote by Alan Hansen where he said that you can't win nothing with kids, and he played his fledglings, his academy graduates, and they went on to win the league that season, or in fact a double that season. So I think, you know, what impresses me most about Sir Alex is the fact that he has immense faith in more the system. I mean, obviously his abilities were that of a great manager, but you know, the fact that if given an opportunity, you know, he had players who would actually, you know, die on the pitch for him. He was that kind of a manager, and you would want to play for Alex Ferguson.
But you know, that's so extraordinary. It's extraordinary you should say that, because that's exactly what I was thinking about. Here you have a man who could mold young people into stars. I mean, would you say Sir Alex Ferguson was loved?
I think so. I think, you know, you've got to look at it from two perspectives. You know, the United fans, if you remember in 2005, when we had a very, very ordinary season by our own standards, you know, you had an upheaval of sorts in the club where, you know, Roy Keane was sold to Celtic. And there were chance of Fergie out, and there were chance of you don't know what you're doing. It was remarkable, you know, given the fact that he brought so much, you know, glory to the club by then. But I'm sure he knew what he was doing. At the end of the day, you know, and you're going to see it on Sunday. The fans, I think, you know, the moment we heard of his departure from the club or his retirement, I think, you know, there was something in you. I mean, I'm sitting here in New Delhi, and I've just been there for a few games at Manchester in 2009 or 2008-09. I could feel the numbness because I know what exactly those guys are going through, and it's his legacy is something that's very it'll be very hard to replicate. I think there's only one Sir Alex, as we think, we say. I mean, the other perspective is he may not be loved by fans of other clubs, but there's sure a lot of respect. I think there's a lot of respect among fans of other clubs, and they've been very gracious.
He inspires loyalty. That's what strikes me. And that's where I wanted to come to JP for the next question. I mean, can you think of another manager that inspires that kind of loyalty in English Premier League football or even in international football? I mean, what about Mourinho, who for a while was Ferguson's big nemesis in England? What about Wenger, right? I mean, the two certainly had their wars of words, the two of them.
Yeah, I think Arsene Wenger is more likely to be somebody, you know, like him, you know, because, you know, he's been... how many years now? How many?
Wenger came to Arsenal in 1998.
No, sorry, he was 98, 96. So you can do the math.
Yes.
I'm not good at it, so...
96, you know, Arsene Wenger...
97, you are, 98.
You know, few of them. Few of them, really, you know. I think Sir Alex is, you know, is just unique, you know. You can't
replicate it, that's right.
Anyone else. He has his, you know, his own, you know, default, like he was, you know, mean to people sometimes to his own players. Remember when he was throwing the shoes to Beckham, things like that, you know. But he was, overall, he was a good manager.
Mm-hmm. One final question to the two of you. Where do you see, you know, English Premier League football going from here? I know, Venkat, you said you expected, you know, it would take a while, you know, for David Moyes to work himself into the system, so to speak. But where do you see in the next few years English Premier League football going after the end of the reign of Sir Alex Ferguson?
I think the difference. I think it's important to make a difference. I mean, I think everybody, every ex-player of a different club other than United has been predicting doomsday. But I don't think it's exactly doomsday. If you look at the team that David Moyes is inheriting, it's a champion team, And with the money he's going to get from all these commercial partnerships and also being league winners and television rights and all those things, he's definitely going to look to improve the team. So I don't see Manchester United slagging off. I expect them to be challenging, for trophies in the next few years. Where I see a problem is impatience. I think as I told you before, we have been spoiled by Sir Alex Ferguson in terms of the fact that we win trophies
and
every
how.
Year, if not once in 2 years, but that is something that David Moyes will have to recognize. I hope he wins a trophy early, even though it could be a club, even if it's a cup, if it's not the league. I mean, I think if he wins a trophy early, I'm sure his reign would be more exciting. And even without that, I imagine we'd be doing quite well. I think Chelsea will be a force because they'll spend money. City is always going to be at a behind, if I could say that. Arsenal, I think have the edge because of the financial situation that they are in at the moment, and they have all the money to spend if they choose to spend. I'm happy to give David Moyes a chance, and I think it's a great appointment. We are all excited, and there'll be stability. You're going to see a lot of similarities between Alex Ferguson and David Moyes.
JP, how do you see it to conclude?
Or he's going
to
get a knighthood very quickly, but there could be something to cherish. I hope so.
JP, how do you see it?
I would like the English football and Manchester United to hire more African players. You know, Manchester got his first African player in 1999. It was the South African Quinton Fortune. You know, English football wasn't used to play African players because they didn't trust them, because they were thinking maybe they were not, working enough on the pitch or something like that. But I think the new players like the Drogbas and the Yaya Toure show them that, African player can be, skillful and then, physical and all of that, And I think African players are a force that to be reckoned with. And then English football could improve if they, hire more African players for the future.
Okay. Well, listen, thanks very much to the two of you.
The
legacy of Sir Alex Ferguson. I hope we get a chance to chat again before too long. Thanks a lot, guys.
Shine bright like a diamond. Shine bright like a diamond. Fine light in the beautiful sea. I chose to be happy. You and I. We're like diamonds in the sky. You're a shooting star, I see. A vision of ecstasy. When you hold me, I'm alive. We're like diamonds in the sky.
I see. like a diamond. Shine bright like a diamond. Shine bright like a diamond. So shine bright.
So a few weeks ago, a friend's posting on Facebook prompted me to contact Fiona Riley, who's an Australian travel writer living in China, in Shanghai more precisely. And my friend's Facebook entry was about street food in Shanghai, something about which Fiona Riley on her blog, which is called Life on Nanchanglu.blogspot.com, you know, she talks a lot about street food in the Chinese metropolis and, you know, lots of beautiful photos, lots of beautiful entries and recipes and things like that. And so that prompted me to give her a call. She graciously agreed to join us on the show today, even though she lives in Australia. Well, she lives in Shanghai, but she is in Australia at the moment, in Queensland, to be more precise. And just so you know, there's 14 and a half hours time difference between Washington, D.C. and I believe Brisbane, where she is staying at the moment. So enjoy this conversation. China is home to lots of ethnic and minority groups. And I was going to ask, to what extent do you see their food cultures represented in Shanghainese street stalls? For example, you can think about, you know, Uyghur food, you know, which is very different from what outsiders like myself usually know about Chinese food, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. And I think Shanghai's street foods are really a reflection of the city's ethnic diversity and actually of the pride these ethnic groups have in their local cuisine. So when I talk about ethnic groups, I don't mean pockets of French people selling crepes from a cart, but actually the ethnic groups within China's own 56 different ethnic groups. And you mentioned the Uyghurs from far western China, who are a Muslim minority, and they're often unfairly sidelined and blamed for all kinds of problems, from petty theft to terrorism. But when it comes to street food, suddenly there are no barriers, just a shared love of Uyghur cuisine. And I've actually never met a Chinese person who didn't love Uyghur food, the salty, juicy, char-grilled lamb and the samsas, the pastries filled with spiced mutton and vegetables, or the beautiful ruby-red, freshly squeezed pomegranate juice. And so, you know, those kind of ethnic groups have this very strong culture within Shanghai that is very much focused around their street foods. And so it's lovely to walk the streets and to see, you know, oh, there's a grilled lamb stall selling Uyghur lamb kebabs, but next to them is a Lanzhou pulled noodles shop that sells noodles from a different part of China. And you know, next to them might be a little Miao ethnic group shop that sells a sort of salty, sour, spicy fish soup. So the foods are incredibly diverse and different, but it does really reflect the reality of that diversity in Shanghai.
Now, to what extent has industrialization prompted the growth of food culture? Because after all, Shanghai is a huge city and has been, you know, for a while. But, you know, industrialization, perhaps the need to get, you know, lunch on the quick before returning to work, that sort of things.
Yeah, and I think street food fulfills a lot of those needs. Like, it's a very cheap, tasty form of sustenance for people on low incomes. It's also a delicious convenience for those who have more money. But I think, you know, Shanghai's emergence as this sort of magnetic economic powerhouse within China means that it has a hold for people from all over China who've migrated from the countryside to seek their fortune. And along with that, they've brought with them their local ethnic foods. You know, so Shanghai's emerged as this almost mythical place of tremendous opportunity where you can come with very little skill or capital and build yourself a living out of almost nothing. And I think before Deng Xiaoping's economic reforms, that would have been unthinkable for somebody with some ambition and entrepreneurial skill to leave their home in the countryside and try their luck in the big city. But suddenly moving vast distances to chase these opportunities became acceptable and then increasingly desirable to make a better life for yourself with whatever limited skills you had, whether that was working as a laborer or collecting and recycling garbage. But, you know, some people had nothing but their cooking skills, and so they set up snack stalls or carts selling the food from their hometowns. And now for many of those millions of migrants who live in Shanghai, and some people put that number at about 10 million people.
Wow. And again, I'm sorry,
massive,
but the population,
it's
about a population of 20 million.
Of the food from their hometown.
Doesn't Shanghai have a population of about 20 million or so?
Yeah, it's a bit hard to pin it down exactly, but it's probably around 24 million.
Wow.
And probably about 10 million of those are people who are not ethnically Shanghainese.
Mm-hmm. Now, this being said, some of the recipes you mention on your blog are really, really old, such as zhongzhe, if I don't butcher the pronunciation, which I believe are rice balls in bamboo leaves, right?
Oh, yes, zhongzhe, you had it so close. That was great.
Good, super. All right.
Yeah, that's a lovely snack. It's actually one of my favorite street foods. They're these little pyramids sort of shaped green packages, and inside is sticky rice, and you can have sweet zhongzhe that have sweet red bean, or you can have savory zhongzhe that have sort of fatty pork in the center that kind of melts into the rice and makes it really delicious.
Mm.
But they're a food that's eaten all year round in Shanghai, but they're actually most traditional at the time of the Dragon Boat Festival.
Which is?
Sorry, go on.
No, which is? The Dragon Boat Festival?
Which is in June, in the middle of summer in China, and it basically commemorates the death of a very beloved poet. And I can't remember the story in a great deal of accuracy, but I believe he committed suicide, but the people who supported and followed him were so devastated by his death that they rowed out in boats into the river. He committed suicide by drowning himself, and in order to prevent the fish from eating his body, they threw little packets of rice into the river to distract the fish. And so those little packets of rice became symbolic of the poet, and the boats became the dragon boats that are now raced down rivers in all over China during Dragon Boat Festival. So it's quite a lovely story, but it's a food that everybody still eats today.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, one of those zhongzhe goes for something, I think you said something like 15 or 20 U.S. cents. I believe, by the way, you're Australian. I believe the Australian and the U.S. dollar run at about the same rate these days.
Yeah, they're equivalent, yeah.
Yes. And so you mentioned zhongzhe going for about 15 to 20 cents?
Yes, that's right. So they're really inexpensive, as most street foods are. It's rare to find a street food meal that would cost you more than, say, one U.S. dollar.
Wow. And what are some of your other personal favorites?
Oh, I've got so many. But I guess one of my favorites, it was one of my first discoveries in Shanghai when I first moved there. And on my street every morning I would notice this queue leading down a tiny lane, and I could always smell this beautiful, toasty, buttery smell. But the queue moved so slowly, I joined it a few times and I never got anywhere near the front, and I still had no idea what was being cooked and I couldn't speak Chinese. But it was months before I finally waited an hour and a half to get to the front of the queue, and there was a tiny doorway in a tiny kitchen blackened with soot and lit by this single light bulb on a wire. And inside was an elderly hunchback man who makes Shanghai's best scallion pancakes. They're called songyobing.
Nice.
And they're a savory pancake, about as big as a saucer. They're very light and buttery, almost like a brioche. and studded through with finely sliced scallions and little nubbins of salty pork. And so I never, ever tire now of standing in that queue because he just works at his own rhythm, rolls the dough, rubs it with butter, sprinkles it with the pork and the scallions, and then rolls it up, presses it down onto the hot griddle, and then waits patiently for each side to cook before he turns it. And then he finishes it off inside this incredibly primitive oven made from a 44-gallon drum lined with concrete. And the first day that I stood there waiting, the man in front of me bought all 20 pancakes in that batch and told me that he comes once a week and buys enough for a whole week of breakfast for his family.
Beautiful.
And the lady behind me had actually flown from Hong Kong because she'd heard about how good these pancakes were and just
wanted
to try them. So he's still my favorite street food vendor in Shanghai. And whenever I have a spare hour and a half, I go and stand in line and wait for one.
Okay, well, there you go, an hour and a half. What does that tell you? Why do you think there is such a growing worldwide interest in street food culture generally? Because there's no way that interest is just limited to Shanghai.
No, of course not. And, you know, in some ways I've been a little bit protected from what's happening in the rest of the world in China. And every time I come back to Australia and I realize just how incredibly popular street food is becoming, I think there's a lot of reasons. I think in this world of increasing globalization and everything's becoming more and more homogenous, street food is intensely local and it's quite difficult to reproduce. And I think the other thing is that it's very nostalgic for a lot of people. It reminds them of the food of their childhood or of a particular place. Maybe it's a place they grew up, maybe it's a place they've only visited. But I think street food has those attractions for people. And then on top of that, it's convenient, it's fast, and sometimes we just want, you know, we want to sit somewhere and just have a meal for 20 minutes or even 10 minutes. And not the fuss and bother of a restaurant. So there's a lot of reasons, but in my mind, that's some of them.
You are listening to Independence West. I'm Robert D.
Grandola Vila Morena, terra da fraternidade, o povo é quem mais ordena, dentro de ti ó cidade, dentro de ti ó cidade, o povo é quem mais ordena, terra da fraternidade, Grândola Vila Morena. Em cada esquina um amigo, em cada rosto igualdade, Grândola Vila Morena, terra da fraternidade, terra da fraternidade, Grândola Vila Morena. À sombra de uma azinheira que já não sabia a idade, jurei ter por companheira grandola a tua vontade.
mostrando la tua vontade. Giurai te, pur compagnaira, assombrando ma signaira, che già non sabia età.
So we're happy to have media training consultant Rishko Saribas on the show. And actually, you are based at present in Luanda, Angola, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Which I understand to be one of the world's most expensive cities, which is not necessarily something you would expect in sub-Saharan Africa.
No, it's not. But it's the most expensive city. Actually, it's the world's third most expensive city for expats, not for the locals. Because there's really two levels. At one level, you have expats, and usually, because the city was always expensive, and even before it was the third most expensive in the world, it was always expensive. So what happens is that oil companies, for instance, you know, you're trying to get a one-bedroom apartment inside the city, it'll probably cost you $8,000.
You know, I have heard that number before, and I don't know if you were the one who gave me that number a few years ago, but that's absolutely insane.
Well, what happens is that the oil companies are partially and mostly responsible for the inflation because for them, I mean, they can afford everything. And they need lots of apartments for their personnel to stay at while they're rotating in and out of the country for R&R. And so what happens is that, you know, Texaco and Chevron and whatever, for them it's not a big deal. So they'll pay anything for a one-bedroom apartment. By the time oil companies start paying $8,000 of rent for a one-bedroom apartment inside the city, no one else is going to get a better deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you're trying to bargain your price down, what happens is that they will, you know, they'll say, you know what, I'll wait for an offer from an oil company. They'll pay what I'm asking for. And so that's how it goes as far as you can live outside the city. There's a new, you know, a new Luanda, it's called Luanda Sul or Luanda South, and there's a neighborhood called Benfica and another one called Belas, and you can stay there, and for $5,000 you can get a nice three-bedroom apartment with three master bedrooms in a condo with a swimming pool and everything. But then you have Luanda's horrific traffic to deal with, and it will probably take you, you know, 2.5 to 3 hours to get to downtown to work. So you have to either, you know, put up the traffic or pay up a lot. What a lot of people do, those that can afford it, they have drivers, and the driver will come and pick you up, and the whole time you're in traffic, while your driver is driving, you know, you're in the next seat working. You know, bring your laptop, bring your paperwork, and start working while you are on your way to work.
But listen, this sounds absolutely insane. And in fact, you mentioned oil company employees, which is fine. But what about, say, for example, the Angolan teacher or the Angolan, you know, civil service employee?
It's hard to imagine they're
anywhere near the amount of money required to pay those rents.
No, those are not living in downtown near the center of the city.
Wow.
They live in the suburbs where the government has been building what they call new centralities or new cities. And they live there in these new cities that the government is building from the ground up. And they're trying to get affordable housing that runs at about $500 to $600 a month. And it's affordable for most, you know, people of the new Angolan middle class, because there's a new post-war Angolan middle class. One of the reasons the traffic is so horrendous is that the city was planned for 500,000 people and probably only, you know, 200,000 cars, and there's now at least 2 million cars in there. You know, so there's no way to move.
But those
people now, they can afford the housing that the government is building, which is, of course, not of the same quality, but it's nevertheless, you know, an improvement over what the traditional housing for the less well-off used to be down there.
But, Luisa, this is Roger, you know, with ID West as well. Now, I'm sure the Angola government has something, you know, equal to the Department of Housing, right? Who regulate all these things?
I'm sorry? I couldn't hear that.
Who regulate, like, the price and all that kind of stuff? Is it just free for me to just come and start pricing my apartment any way the way I want, or
does... It's pretty much, you know, call it wild capitalism. I mean, you know, anyone can ask whatever they want. I have a friend before new construction caught up. There was, because construction comes up in lulls, you know, there's people build, you know, a few buildings and then they stop, and in between this building wave and the next wave, that's when the prices go up. And then, you know, once new buildings show up, the oil companies move over there, the buildings that used to cost, 8,000, the new buildings, they can probably cost now, you know, 6 or 7. And a friend of mine was actually able to get one for 5,000 because the owner was holding out for an oil company. And of course, the oil companies have just snatched up some really brand new apartments nearby. So he ended up getting an apartment at a one bedroom for $5,000 because, you know, everybody was kind of, you know, there was enough going around. Yeah, but right now, there's not enough going around. There's a collection of brand new buildings being built right now. Once those are ready, you know, then people are going to start moving over to those ones. And then the ones that are now very expensive become cheaper and so on and so forth. So it's basically, you know, it's just market at its worst or its best, whatever way you look at it.
Luis, before I ask the next question, I want to introduce François Sou, who is our producer, who is our favorite producer here on Independence West, who was not able to make it here today. Roger Muntu is so heartbroken and so despaired, you know, that he had to produce the show himself. He shaved his head in despair.
That's right.
So, you know, that's really, I mean, this is complete chaos here at the Voice of America without François Sou. France, you don't hate me, right? That's not the reason you're not here today.
No, that's
you haven't
not
been
reason.
Kidnapped. I don't have a ransom to pay for you or anything like that.
No, not at all. Everything will be settled by Monday. So you
I think everything will be settled if Robert buys you or buys you an apartment in Angola in Luanda.
I know, right?
No, but come on, man. No, François Sou is the one who has to buy us an apartment in Angola when she's like a media megastar or something like that. So did you want to ask Luis a question? I think I cut you off, France.
Yes, I do. First of all, after what he said, it seems like this pricing actually acts like a circle. Basically, when one place is expensive because of some building of some oil companies there, as soon as those people move towards another area, the old area gets cheaper. Then my question was, how about the food? Like, is food also that expensive? Because I guess if in a certain area, like you said, the New Angola, places are expensive, I guess, you know, getting food there must also be expensive.
It depends on where you go. If you eat traditional Angolan food, you know, in the popular neighborhoods, you know, it's cheap. You know, you can eat for $5 or $6. If you go to the trendy restaurants in an island near the Luanda Bay, it can run you at $150 per person, and you don't have to be very extravagant. You know, if you eat seafood and if you drink a nice wine, it doesn't have to be great wine. Just eat seafood and a nice wine, and you're looking at a tab of $150 per person.
Hmm. You know, it's funny you should say that.
You know, but you can also, what a lot of companies do, they have their own cafeterias, subsidized cafeterias, so that the workers don't have to pay these outrageous prices, those who work in downtown. And, you know, you can also, you know, if you know the city and if you know the locals, they'll point you to nice places where you can have a cheap meal. And a cheap meal around here, it's something in the neighborhood of, you know, between $50 and $60.
You know, it's funny you should say that. It's funny you should say that because a few years ago in Haiti, I met a Taiwanese restaurant owner, right? And his story was that he was an agricultural engineer by trade, but he had lived and worked in several developing countries. And he was telling me the difference between opening a restaurant, say, in Cameroon or in Haiti, as opposed to opening a Chinese restaurant in Luanda, Angola. And he was telling me in Angola, that's where he had made the most money because of all the oil money in that town.
Yes, there's a lot of very wealthy people. There is a new Angola middle class, and on top of that Angola middle class sits a very, very wealthy wealthy class, very wealthy.
But let me ask you this:
and for those who can afford it, you know, there's restaurants where you have dinner for $500 per person and more, and they're always pretty crowded, you know. So, but the thing is, you know, not everybody gets to go there. Not everybody gets to get the best.
That's right. Not everybody gets to get there. Robert. You know, as I was reading, a British music producer, Mark Voisey, said he paid $700 a night for a room at Epixana Hotel. He said he knew Luanda. He knew that Luanda wasn't cheap, but he didn't expect to pay $32 for a room service hamburger.
Nice.
$32, right?
$32, as far as room service goes, $32 is pretty much the standard.
Wow.
That's the standard for a hamburger. That's the standard for something called prego no pão, which is a small steak on a small loaf of bread. It's a Portuguese expression. Mm-hmm. That's about $30. You know, an espresso at a hotel, between $5 and $6.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So when it comes to room service, all bets are off, and the Epixana is, the most luxurious and the newest hotel in Luanda, so I'm not surprised.
Mm.
I think their lowest room goes for the cheapest room there, I think, goes for $500.
Wow.
You know what, Luis? You know, I don't do diet, but I know if I get to Luanda, I have to get on a diet, like, on a daily basis. Otherwise, I won't make it. It's too expensive.
Nice.
And I have a question. Like this week we had a show which is called Washington Forum, where we talk a little bit about how Africa is actually portrayed as the continent which has the biggest growth in the economy. Am I right? I think so. Yes. And I was wondering, do you actually see this growth like in everyday living people, like everyday? Every citizen in Luanda, it's true that the town is expensive, but science, because of the oil money and all that, and the whole industry, Angola is making money. But do you even feel that, you know, people are actually living, you know, comfortably, at least at the minimum standard in Luanda?
A lot of people do not, because there's a great disparity in income distribution, and a lot of people do not, you know, particularly the people who live in what it's called Museke, which is the equivalent to the Brazilian favelas or shantytowns.
Slums.
Those people still don't have the access to the things that any middle class would take for granted. And that's because there is still a lot of disparity in the distribution of the national income. And, you know, the government run on last year's campaign on the slogan of, you know, grow more to distribute better. And there's certainly a promise that they're going to be held up to by the electorate, by the voters, because better distribution of the results of that growth in economic income that the country's gotten, better distribution of that is something that millions of Angolans are still waiting for.
Wow.
Listen, Luis, we're going to leave it there because I know you have a busy day today. So on behalf of all of us here, thank you for taking a few minutes to talk to us about how outrageously expensive Luanda is. Still hope I get a chance to visit the city one day. And listen, all the best as you prepare to return.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Take care, brother.
And this will do it for this week. You've been listening to Independence West. I'm Robert D.
Listening to Independence West on VOA.